Great, thanks. So I'm going to talk briefly about integrated non-communicable diseases into existing health structures in South Africa, particularly in Johannesburg, where our office is based. I don't have any relationships to disclose. So what I'm going to do is start off by talking just a little bit about some of the challenges that people face in particularly an urbanizing township environment, and then talk about how Project Hope is addressing some of those issues. Just to give you a real sort of brief overview of the health system in South Africa, we have two parallel systems. We have a private healthcare system and we have a public healthcare system. The private services 14% of the population and the public services 86% of the population, and they both roughly spend the same amounts of money per year. So you have real high class, top quality care in the private sector, and you have very substandard, I'd say, care in the public sector. We've seen before in the previous presentation, we have these risk factors. And we've been told that if you address these risk factors, you can reduce the burden of these NCDs. It's not that straightforward. And the reason why it's not that straightforward is because there are these physical barriers or physical challenges that are in these communities that we work in that really prevent people from the exercise and changing the diets and things like that. And so in our program, we've identified four of these barriers, and I'm just going to talk about them very briefly. So we're all aware of the rise in obesity issues here in the US, in my country, in the UK, and across Europe. But that evolution of man that's happened here in the Western world, it's also happening in the developing world, and particularly in Africa as well. But when outsiders, even our animals, so as outsiders, when we think about Africa, what's the first thing that comes to your mind? Well, it's often starving children, right? So we think about the 1980s Ethiopian famine and things like that. And that's still happening. So we still have famine and we have starvation and we have hunger. But parallel in that is this sort of rise in obesity levels on the continent, but specifically sort of South Africa is one of the countries that's leading the way. And we've had a number of studies done, and there was one a couple of years back, and South Africa was ranked third fattest country in the world, below the US and then the UK in that study. So we know that traditionally food insecurity is related to sort of famine and to starvation and to hunger, but what's happening in South Africa is we're having this sort of, I guess, new emerging insecurity where due to economic circumstances, a person has to decide between good nutritional security and cheaper, less healthy food options. So if you're living in a township environment where unemployment rates are, 50, 60% sometimes, you may be living off a government grant, but that's going to be $50 to $100 a month. You've got an average of 5 people in your family to feed. What are you going to do? Are you going to eat the fruits and vegetables that cost a lot more than the less healthier food options? We don't have the same problem in South Africa like you do here in the US with these food deserts or food swamps, where in a sort of geographic area there's no physical availability of good nutritional food. We have availability of most fruits and vegetables. A lot of the stuff's grown in South Africa. And even in the townships, you'll see people selling some apples and bananas and spinach and things like that. But the issue is that they are often blocked due to lack of financial means. And so for the urban poor in South Africa, survival often dictates what you eat on a daily basis. So if you're diabetic or you're hypertensive, food is a real barrier, I guess, to trying to control that disease. The second barrier is this issue of exercise. So we've seen, like here, you've moving from sort of a previously active life to a more sedentary lifestyle. In Johannesburg, a lot of people have come from rural areas, or they've come from other countries where they used to work in the fields, they used to grow their own food, and they've moved into these urbanizing areas, these townships, and really where you just can't physically exercise. So here's a picture of the township that we work in. You can just see there's sewage running through the streets. If you're a woman, it's very unsafe to exercise. There's no lighting in the evenings, there's no electricity. And so really just actually trying to exercise in these environments is really quite difficult. And we know that even in the best of circumstances, when you're told that you need to exercise and you have the best gym equipment and the best support systems, even a lot of people in those circumstances fail. Then the third barrier that we have is this issue of sort of access to clinical care. Waiting times in clinics are just prohibitive. I work in the area that we work in, it's 200,000 people. We have one government clinic staffed with four nurses and a doctor half a day a week. So you can just imagine sort of the wait times for these people, and the clinic that we're associated with, people get there at 4:30 in the morning. By 7 o'clock, the doors are closed, and then people are sort of in the clinic waiting the whole day to get seen by a nurse. So that the primary care system in South Africa is really just focused on sort of just trying to manage emergencies, basically. There's no preventative care that takes place, really, at the moment. And then finally, the last barrier that's associated with this is this lack of patient empowerment. So you can just imagine that if you're a nurse in a clinic and you've got to see all of these patients during the day, A, you're not going to be treating them very well. By the end of the day, you're going to be pretty rude to them. B, the opportunity you have to educate patients is really very limited. So for diabetes education, they basically say, don't eat sugar and exercise more and off you go, take your tablets. I mean, that's the extent of the education that takes place. So this whole idea of patient empowerment, knowing your numbers, being in charge of your disease, it doesn't happen whatsoever. And that's a real issue, and we see that. South Africa is very interesting because we have free medication. So that's very different compared to a lot of other sub-Saharan African countries where you have to pay for your medicine. But even though the medication is free, we have really poor adherence rates to the medication and correspondingly poor patient outcomes. Whereas in other countries where you'll see, you know, patients having to buy their medicines, they actually have better, they have some better outcomes. And you figure that that's due to the fact that, you know, if a patient doesn't understand what the medicine is doing, if they're just told, take these tablets, you know, when they feel better, why would they continue taking the medication? They would stop. So what's our response to this? We really feel that there needs to be a real overhaul in the way primary care is done. To meet these challenges, I think there needs to be two main things. One is task shifting. So you're going to have to task shift down. We don't have enough nurses. We don't have enough medical professionals. So to reach the population with these services, and due to budgetary constraints, you're going to have to task shift down to use trained lay workers, which are cheaper and more readily available. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is we don't have enough facilities, so you need to take primary care out to where the people are and not expect people to come into a clinic. So we have a program, it's called the Hope Center Program. It's funded through the Eli Lilly NCD Partnership. Our academic partner is the University of Pretoria, and we work very closely with the City of Johannesburg Health Department. And we work in the two townships. They border right next to each other. Zandspruit, it's an informal settlement. It's about 70,000 people there at shacks, basically. And then Cosmos City, which is right next door. Again, it's about 70,000 people. And that's the formal settlement, and the difference is that it's recognized by the government, and they have this sort of low-cost subsidized housing that people get given. And so what we did at the beginning of this year was we wanted to find out what was going on in this community. We sort of had an idea, but we wanted to sort of get some data, and so we did a baseline survey. And we looked at a number of different things. This is just some results of our, we did sort of randomized sampling in all the various different extensions of the communities. And these are the results. They were pretty similar, both townships, but you can see, you know, 25% of people were obese, 27% were overweight in Cosmos City, and similar in Zandsprite. We did a health knowledge assessment, which was really interesting. I don't have the results here in my presentation, but 85% of people in Zandsprite and 89% in Cosmos City, they knew that to maintain a healthy weight or a healthy lifestyle, you had to eat healthy and combine that with exercise. So what we're seeing is that the knowledge is there. So it's not like people don't know that eating poorly is going to affect your health. It's there, but they can't. There are these physical barriers in the community that prevent people from taking that knowledge and changing the way that they eat and the way that they behave to have a healthier lifestyle. So we take a sort of a three-pronged approach to tackling some of these challenges. The first thing that we do is we run these community screening days. And we use community health workers or lay people as well as the final year nursing students from a local nursing college. We basically set up gazebos in the various communities and we screen for, we do random blood glucose, BMI, blood pressure, and then we give out health education. And to date we've screened about, in the last 4 months, we've screened about 1,300 people. It's a real just nice visible way. And what's really nice in South Africa is with the HIV sort of money that's come into the country, you know, loads of people have been tested for HIV. So there's this desire to get tested. So we never have a problem of not trying to find people. Everyone wants to get tested. It's not an issue there. For the people that have abnormal values, we're then able to refer them to a clinic. This is just some results. It's a couple of weeks old. Predominantly screening females, and that's because females are just more there in the community. A lot of males have gone out to other parts to work in the mines and things like that. And also females are the ones that are walking to the shops or walking to their sort of informal employment, and so they come into contact with us more. Body mass index, you can see, you know, 43% of women that we screened were obese compared to 12.7% of men. And that's just, I mean, it's just really visible in the community. You see just very large women and quite skinny men. There's cultural issues to do with that as well. With blood pressure, what's interesting is that we have, whilst we have more female patients in our clinic with high blood pressure, the men have higher, the fewer men that we've screened have higher blood pressure, pre-hypertension and hypertension. That's their systolic, that's their diastolic, and then the random blood glucose. So 4%, and I'm not sure, this is in millimolars, so I'm not sure what the conversion is for here, but 11 millimolars right then and there, they have diabetes and you put them straight on treatment. 33%. Have between 5.6 and 11. So what we do with those is we refer them for a fasting plasma glucose and then confirm whether or not they have diabetes. And then 63 were normal. The second part of the program is that we work very closely with the primary care clinic, the government primary care clinic, and we run a three-day-a-week diabetes and hypertension service. That's staffed, again, by health professionals. We have two professional nurses, and then we use community health workers as well. So what we do is the nurses diagnose and the nurses write prescriptions, but basically everything else that's done in the clinic is done by community health workers. So it's our health workers that use our point-of-care testing machines to run the lipograms and run the HbA1cs. They do the foot screening. They do the sort of pre-blood pressure and BMI checks. And then from January, we have a retinal camera come in, and they'll be trained on taking the photos on the retinal camera. And so the idea for using community health workers is that just because of the volume of patients, you need to get them in and out quickly. And if you want to overcome that sort of negative has said people don't come to the clinic because they have to wait all the time and they can't take time off work. So we've got to get patients in and out a lot quicker and a lot more, I guess, efficiently, but we can't sort of increase our staff because there's no availability. So we've got to be more efficient with the way that we get patients in and out. So we have a standard 45-minute, that's our goal, maximum patient waiting time to get into the clinic, see the nurse, and get out. Then I guess the final component of the program is, which I think is probably the most interesting for me at least, is the peer support element to it. So if you think about the whole continuum of care, you've got the prevention and you've got the screening. Patients come from that into the clinic, they get confirmation of diagnosis, they get put on treatment if needed, and then the patients go through the clinic, and then the education gets done outside of the clinic. So our nurses don't educate. We want our nurses to diagnose and treat, and that's it, because they've got to see patients. The education can be done, we believe, cheaper and more effectively outside in the community where the people are. And so what happens is our patients will receive a home visit within a week of their initial diagnosis, where a community health worker goes. They check up on the patient. You know, when you've been diagnosed with diabetes and the nurse asks you, have you got any questions? You usually don't have questions then and there. It's usually a couple of days later that you may have some questions, but you may not have an appointment with the nurse for another month. So we are able to then answer those questions. We do a pill count. We check compliance. We check for side effects. A lot of the patients have issues with the metformin, with the sort of the bloating and the gas that happens with that. And so often patients just stop taking the medicine, so we deal with those sort of issues. And then after that home visit, they'll get put into support groups. And our support groups, we're just finalizing it. We're using Abraham's 5 steps curriculum and adding some things to that. But the patients will go into a peer support group with about 10 patients per group. They meet once a week in their homes, or in their shacks, for a period of a year. And in that, they get comprehensive health education. That expands, you know, it does the NCDs, it does hypertension, it does diabetes, but it also does HIV and TB co-infection, gestational diabetes, things like that. They get nutritional support. So we're not just telling them, you know, you need to eat better. We're giving them cooking classes, we're giving them urban food gardening classes, trying to make that whole sort of access to healthier food and availability to healthier food more of a reality. They also then get exercise classes, so we're teaching them how to exercise in their shacks, and then also sort of forming up group exercise sessions, which is particularly important for the women who don't feel like they can exercise by themselves in the community. So if you get a group together and they go walking or things like that, that's combined then with, you know, foot care to make sure that their feet are okay and they've got the correctly fitting shoes before they start any exercise, making sure that they understand what the signs and symptoms of hypoglycemia is so that they don't have an adverse effect to sort of change their diet and they're starting to exercise, which can then put patients off from the exercise and the diets. So we're doing that. And we believe basically that if you combine the use of sort of health professionals with community health workers, you can save the health system money. So we think about patients who are empowered, less times they need to go to the clinic. You can use point of care machines. They don't have to come twice to the clinic. So to get their results, they get their results within 6 minutes. They have less complications because they're better controlled, which is obviously a cost saving. And then using community health workers allows you to expand that clinical service cost effectively. Because a community health worker will cost you about, I don't know, it's under $100 a month for a full-time physician in South Africa compared to a few $1,000s a month for a nurse. And so by doing that, we're able to sort of very cost-effectively expand the clinical services and ultimately improve the patient's life. So thank you.